This morning, we begin by having Larry Dulcie here with us. We, in fact, don't only have Larry at the conference, we also have his wife, Barbie, who is extremely well known. And both Barbie and I have something in common, and that is Florence Nightingale, because I did my medical training at St. Thomas's. And Barbie is, of course, an expert in the field. And any of you who are interested in Florence Nightingale's history might like to have a word with her. I can't actually see her at the moment. Where are you, Barbie? Yeah, over there. So anybody who wants to talk to her about Florence Nightingale, you'll find nobody on the planet more knowledgeable. Now, let me introduce you to Larry. Larry, I have to confess, but do it willingly and happily, is one of my heroes. He is a man of great intellect, great honesty, great purity, great purpose. He was co-chair of the National Institute of Health, Mind and Body Medicine. Now, to get up there and take that position in a scientific group is enormously difficult, and only people who of the utmost quality will be able to do it. But Larry did that. He is the lead of, consultant lead of which hospital, Larry?
Medical City, Dallas Hospital.
Dallas Hospital. And so he keeps his hand in at medicine. He has written, and it puts us all to shame, well, there may be somebody who excels in this better, but I doubt it. He's written 13 books. Anybody written more than 13 books? Okay. So Larry's leading the field. But most of all, and one of the reasons why he's my hero, is because right early on, he was leading the field on mind-body medicine, non-locality, the influence of love and compassion on healing. He's an astonishing person. And so it's a great pleasure to have him back here again, because he's an old friend of the network, and he comes and has given a number of talks to us here. So I'd like you all to welcome Larry Dulcie.
Well, thank you very much, Peter. Well, I bring greetings from the colonies to all of you. You know, it's ironic that I am going to talk about the one mind when in the U.S. currently we are definitely not of one mind. I will not mention any names. You can fill in the blanks. But I would also like to respond to Peter's comments by saying that I have felt a home here in this organization from the time I joined this group, at a time when the earth was young and my hair was black. And there are two people here who have been a particular inspiration to me. It will be no surprise that these are David Lormer and Peter. As much as I admire these images, I do have two more images of them, which I think really more appropriately captures their essence. Taken in a candid moment. Actually, what Peter did not tell you all is that a couple of weeks ago, as I was preparing my talk, I called Peter and I said, "Do you have any advice for me as I prepare my discussion?" And he said, "Yes, Larry, I definitely do." He said, "When you give your talk, do not attempt to be smart, charming, or intelligent. Just be yourself." It does rate as some of the most valuable advice I've had, and I do thank you for it, Peter. Another hero of mine in the mind-body field is the celebrated University of Virginia psychiatrist Dr. Ian Stevenson. You may know him because he became quite famous because of his research and thousands of cases of children who presumably remember past lives. And Dr. Stevenson said once, "I believe it is better to learn what is probable about important matters than to be certain about trivial ones." I align myself with that point of view. And one of the important matters which I think has arisen in academic research and medicine in recent decades is the concept of the spiritual. Now, spirituality has been sitting on the sidelines in Western cultures and medicine for the better part of the 20th century, but it has made a resurgence. And it goes under several guises: healing intentions, therapeutic intent, prayer, sometimes called compassionate curing, or even good bedside manner, for that matter. There are definite indicators of the re-spiritualization of medicine in the United States. I want only to mention two of them, just to give you an idea that something big is happening in medical care in the U.S., and I don't know how deeply this is spread to the U.K., but I suspect things will not be different ad infinitum, if in fact they are indeed different now. In 1993, there were only 3 medical schools in the entire United States out of a total of about 125 that had any kind of coursework looking at the role of spirituality in health and longevity. As we speak, over 90 medical schools have adopted formal coursework exploring this area. This is a landmark development, folks. It is not a one-off. You cannot now obtain an MD degree in the U.S. from an accredited medical school unless you know the importance of spirituality in caring for your patients. It just is no longer possible. Now, there's something in the U.S. called the Joint Commission on Accreditation, which accredits all of the hospitals and clinics in the United States, and it is required now for accreditation that an institution have a vehicle of some sort whereby they can assess the spiritual health of every patient who comes into the hospital. You cannot be accredited without meeting that requirement. Now, I have heard ever since I was in medical school that good, decent scientists would believe none of this spirituality stuff. You could not be a good scientist and participate, for example, and the issues that are being discussed this weekend here. This is a fiction, and it has gone down. It's just the way things are, but it is false. We know that because of a survey that was done among working biologists, physicists, and mathematicians in the U.S. About 10 years ago. And the survey showed that almost 40% of working biologists, physicists, and mathematicians not only believe in a God, but they believe in a God who would answer prayer. Now, this is not the image that you get as you cycle through pre-med and medical school in the States. It's exactly the opposite. And it is a false contention. Now, I want to give you a brief indication of how we got to this point of honoring spirituality in medicine after it has been sidelined for most of the 20th century. And I want to do that by a kind of historical template. And I would ask you to drop back with me at a moment in history when medicine in the Western world first began to become scientific. This would have been in the decade of the 1860s. Before that, you can imagine what medicine looked like by focusing on therapies such as bleeding and purging and so on. But in the 1860s, things began radically to change in the Western world, including Europe. Now, I want to designate this first historic era as simply mechanical or materialistic medicine, Era I medicine. And it had a particular view of the actions of consciousness, or the non-actions of consciousness, basically. Because in Era I medicine, consciousness is considered to be confined to the brain, and it absolutely does not affect the body in any significant way, and it plays little or no role in health. Now, you all know what Era I medicine looks like. It is still dominant in the Western world. It consists of surgical interventions, various sorts of diagnostic therapies such as fMRI and many others, and also, of course, the use of medications. I am not here to disparage Arrow One Medicine. I have used them as an internist with much gratitude for decades, and they still play a role, but they are incomplete. Now, things began to change radically in the post-World War II era in the West with respect to the way the mind was viewed in health and illness. Beginning in that World War II era, a new conception of the actions of consciousness began to take place. Now we know this as mind-body medicine. When I was in medical school, we called this psychosomatic disease. And I emphasize the word disease because then it was not clear that if consciousness did have an action on the body, it could be positive. And we dwelt at great length on how thoughts could disturb the body. We talked about irritable bowel syndrome, various headache syndromes, essential hypertension, and so on. Since then, we have agonized our way to a concept that, what do you know, consciousness might do something positive. And now, Era 2 medicine, mind-body medicine, is just sort of in the air. Nobody really raises an eyebrow about things like meditation, the use of imagery and visualization, the use of music in therapy. I think everybody is doing yoga, aren't they, these days? It's not contentious any longer. The use of massage is ubiquitous. One of my favorite therapies is biofeedback, heavily researched. Hypnosis belongs in Era 2 mind-body medicine, as do placebo effects, and also stress management. Now, in many areas, mind-body medicine has been virtually equated with stress management, and as grateful as I am to this development, I just want to say that mind-body medicine is much more than managing individual stress. And I want to give you an example of that, and I'm happy to say that this example came from your country in the 1950s. And it is a famous case in the legacy of medicine, and it's not a one-off. Since this case was reported, there have been at least a dozen additional, almost identical cases reported from around the world. And it has to do with a horrible disease. It's called congenital ichthyosis, sometimes called fish skin disease, or sometimes called alligator skin disease. People with severe cases of this used to show up as freaks in sideshows and circuses. This is a genetic abnormality that affects about 1 in 100,000 individuals. And here is a case of a baby born with this disease. And there is no good treatment for this, by the way, even to this day. It affects various parts of the body. This is a case involving the knees. This poor child has a severe facial case of this, and you can see the fissuring of the skin, which leads to its designation sometimes as alligator skin disease. Well, the case in question was reported in 1952 in the British Medical Journal, and when this case was reported, it created a worldwide sensation. The British Medical Journal had to install extra banks of phones to handle phone calls that originated from all over the world. And so the case was a bit complicated. I'll make it short and brief. But it had to do with a 10-year-old boy whose mother took him to a family physician one day for what everybody thought was a severe case of warts. And so this was almost total body warts. So this poor doctor said, what can I do with this? So he sent this child on to a surgeon for treatment, and the surgeon threw up his hands and said, well, I can't resect the whole skin. So the surgeon sent this boy on to an anesthesiologist named Dr. Albert Mason. He did so because Mason used hypnosis in the induction phase of anesthesia for his patients. And everybody has heard of warts sometimes responding to hypnosis, so this doctor thought that, well, you know, this is a sensible thing to do, just send him to somebody who uses hypnosis and is good at it. So Mason did something interesting. He told this boy, who, by the way, proved to be a marvelous hypnotic candidate. He could get very deeply hypnotized very quickly. And so he told this youngster, we're going to hypnotize you, and these warts are going to fall off of your body one extremity at a time. Well, the surgeon, before the referral to Dr. Mason, had taken a biopsy and sent it to the pathologist. And the biopsy came back after Mason had instructed his patient on what they were going to do. The biopsy showed that this was not warts, but a case of congenital erythrodermia. And so what was Mason to do? Nowhere in the history of medicine in all the world has congenital ichthyosis been known to respond to hypnosis. For some strange reason, and in his later writings, Mason says, I have no idea why I did this, but he decided to continue the hypnosis. And one extremity at a time, the ichthyotic skin fell off and was replaced by normal, pink, healthy tissue. Now, if you had seen this kid, you would have known how astonishing this was. This kid had skin lesions all over. They were fissured so deeply that they had become infected. The stench was so bad that no one could be around this child. He had been withdrawn from school. But yet Mason did this terribly illogical therapy, and it worked. Since then, as I mentioned, there have been many cases, at least a dozen, where people who care for these children have also used hypnosis with equal success. I think this forces us to expand our concept of what mind-body interventions can actually accomplish. This was recognized also by one of the leading cancer researchers in the United States, Dr. Lewis Thomas, who was director of research for many years at Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in the U.S. Thomas said that this case was so important that we should develop a National Institute of Warts to find out how the heck this stuff takes place. Well, the reason I'm enthusiastic about the subject of this conference is because of what I want to designate as Era 3 medicine or non-local medicine. And we're obliged to hypothesize this because we're deep in the middle of it now. This form of medical intervention has a new attitude toward consciousness. It goes far beyond the Era 2 concept that your mind can affect your body. The hypothesis here is that your mind can affect not just your body as in Era 2, but the body of somebody else at a distance, even though they may be unaware that you are having the intention or the willing, the wishing, or the prayer, or whatnot. Now, I want to suggest before we get deeper into this discussion that Era 2, 1, 2, and 3 are not exclusive. They overlap, and sometimes it's difficult to tease them apart. But it is possible, if you look closely, to see various expressions of these three eras in any given case. And I want to illustrate that by a clinical anecdote from Sir William Osler, who began his career as a medical educator in Canada. After reforming how medicine is taught and practiced in Canada, he was lured to the United States by Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland, where he did the same thing in the United States that he had done in Canada. Well, you Brits lured him away, and he accepted the Regis Chair of Medicine at Oxford, and so he made his mark in Britain also. An interesting thing happened after he had been at Oxford for a year. It came time for the graduation ceremonies, and so Dr. Osler put on those impressive ceremonial robes, which looked very shamanic, I think, and was going to the ceremonies at Oxford. But before he got to Oxford, he dropped by the house of a colleague of his, Sir Ernest Malham, whose 10-year-old boy had a severe case of whooping cough. And in those days, there was no cure for this. And this boy was dying. And so Osler enters the house, and he's asked if he could have a moment with this child. And he was dying because he would not eat or drink anything. No nurse or physician could get him to partake of anything. And so Osler goes in alone with this boy and does a cursory examination of him. And this little boy is astonished. He's never seen anything that even looked like Sir William Osler in these ceremonial robes. And Osler was a big man with this impressive, intimidating handlebar mustache. And so this little boy is just totally captivated. So Osler, who knew every moment what he was doing, pulled out a pocket knife. This must have gotten the little boy's attention further. And he's sitting at the bed, and he reaches over into the bedside stand and picks up a piece of fruit, a pear, and he calmly peels it and then slices it up into bite sizes and sugars it and feeds it to this little boy who takes the whole thing. It's the first nourishment he's had in over a week. And then he dismisses himself from the household and goes to the ceremonies at Oxford. Well, he comes back the next day wearing the robes again and does exactly the same thing for this little boy. The little boy will eat nothing except from Osler. And he comes back the third day again with his robes on. And Sir William Osler, who at that time was the most famous physician in the Western world, came back and did the same thing for this little boy, wearing his robes 30 days in a row. I don't think you get that kind of care very often these days. But I want you to think about what may have happened here. This was a combination of errors 1, 2, and 3. Error 1 symbolized by the food, the actual physical food that the boy ate. Error 2 by the mind-body actions that were set up in the boy himself about expectation, suggestion, and response to whatever Osler was doing. And also, error 3 gets to the mix because of Osler's intentions to heal this boy. And I'm sure that these were operative, not just in the bedroom of the sick boy, but when Osler was away as well. And I'll try to defend that comment later on. Well, I've mentioned the term consciousness, and I think that it's probably smart to take a stab at defining it, because if you use words like that, which are extremely complex and don't offer a definition, you can get into trouble quite quickly. Here's how that works. Here's a man who is drowning, and he says to his faithful dog on the shore, Lassie, get help. Lassie, being an obedient dog, a good dog, gets help. So that's the silliest cartoon I have, so don't worry. So this man drowns because he neglects to define his terms, you see. I'm sure everybody in this room would have their own personal definition of consciousness. I'll just share mine. And it comes from an Eastern definition by Dr. Ramakrishna Rao, who is an eminent consciousness researcher working in India. Consciousness is a fundamental principle that underlies all knowing and being. In a fundamental sense, consciousness is the source of awareness. It is what makes awareness possible. Now, you may think that this is really a mysterious definition that could be cooked up only by California hippies, but I have to tell you that this view has been endorsed by some of the greatest titans in science in the 20th century, including the founder of quantum physics, Max Planck, who said, I regard consciousness as fundamental. I regard matter as derivative from consciousness. Let me repeat that. I regard matter as derivative from consciousness. We cannot get behind consciousness. Everything that we talk about, everything we regard as existing, postulates consciousness. Now, this was not some rogue crank talking about consciousness. As a matter of fact, one of his successors, Erwin Schrödinger, who also won a Nobel Prize in physics in 1933, Although I think that life may be the result of an accident, I do not think that of consciousness. Consciousness cannot be accounted for in physical terms, for consciousness is absolutely fundamental. It cannot be accounted for in terms of anything else. Now, this view of consciousness as fundamental did not die out with this generation of Nobel Prize-winning physicists. It persists in a big way in certain circles in the philosophy of consciousness and mathematics and physics. David Chalmers, who is a key player in the mind-body debate these days, I propose that conscious experience be considered a fundamental feature irreducible to anything more basic. Well, Era 3, as I've already implied, involves what I want to call healing intention or therapeutic intent. And this just involves willing or wanting or wishing or even praying for someone who is in trouble, that the best outcome in their health situation prevail, whatever that may happen to be. And as I said last night, Era 3 involves non-local healing and spirituality. There's no way of avoiding confrontation with spiritual issues in this era of healing. Definitions again. I regard spirituality as a sense of connectedness with something higher, something that goes beyond the individual self or ego, an absolute or immanent transcendent power, whatever name you want to attach to that, whether it's God or Goddess or Allah or the universe. And the conviction also that meaning and value and direction and purpose are valid aspects of this strange world we live in. Spirituality should not be equated with religion. Religion I take to be a codified system of belief, worship, and conduct. It may or may not involve a sense of the spiritual, and it usually takes place in a group of like-minded believers. Now, why has this become an issue that has had such major influence in American medical education? It's straightforward. Based on hundreds of studies, we know that people who follow some sort of spiritual religious path in their life, and I have to say that it does not appear to matter which one they choose, but if they choose one and stick with it, they live on average 7 to 13 years longer than people who do not. And they have a lower incidence of all the major diseases you want to look at, including heart disease and cancer. And we have finally come to the realization in academic medicine that we are no longer justified in trying to weenie out of confronting spirituality and farming it out to priests and rabbis and ministers and so on. We have to confront this because of the tremendous impact of spiritual practices on health and longevity. Now, it's easy to go astray here because I bump into people all the time who think that if they follow a spiritual path, they are guaranteed 7 to 13 years additional length of life and they should never get sick. This is the payback for all that spirituality work they do. I emphasize that we're talking statistics here and averages, which means that there are a lot of people on the other ends of those bell curves who do not experience the gains in longevity and good health. I once made a list of people in history who have been extremely spiritual and God-realized for whom the wheels just fell off their health. And they died horrible diseases. I call these sickly saints. Saint Bernadette was one of those who saw the visions at Lourdes and where the miracles are purported to happen to this day. She died in her early 30s of some horrible disease. It's either disseminated tuberculosis or some form of cancer. We don't know for sure. The most beloved saint in modern India, Ramana Maharshi, died a horrible, painful death of some form of cancer. The Buddha died of food poisoning. Someone fed him tainted meat, which proved to be his final meal. You can look it up. It doesn't seem like a very elevated way for a Buddha to go. So you see in the history of world religions, There's more than one Last Supper. That's supposed to be funny. My wife says, stop using that. That's terrible. Well, so you have these sickly saints who do everything right spiritually, and they die young and sometimes young and of very painful diseases. If you turn that coin over, what you get is not sickly saints. You get healthy reprobates. These are people who do nothing spiritually but seem to live forever and never get sick. I have decided that there's one or two of these in every family. Lest you think that this is a man thing, guess again. You got to take responsibility for this, because these two young ladies live in London. And now, if you think about it, it's not difficult to imagine how spiritual and religious practices might influence health for the better. You can come up with a lot of naturalistic influences. A lot of people who are religiously and spiritually oriented just have excellent health habits. They may smoke less and drink less, except for Episcopalians. They may follow proper dietary precautions. They may tend toward vegetarianism. Social support and rich social networking are health promotive, which many people who are religious experience because they belong to certain congregations. They may experience a sense of positive meaning and purpose in life, which also contribute to health and longevity. So if you lump all of these naturalistic factors in, maybe you don't need any transcendental influence on health and longevity, or maybe not. Now, if we look at areas of research that bear on this ERA 3 or non-local healing dimension, they tend to fall into three categories. There are human studies. There are studies involving non-humans, which I'll explain in a moment. And then there is the area of spontaneous or spectacular healings. Now, I just want to touch on this area of human studies because we've come a long way here. Now, Peter mentioned last night the study of Dr. Jean Ochterberg. It was an fMRI study in which she scanned the brains of subjects who were undergoing healing influence from a group of Native American shamanic healers. And the way she did this study is extremely instructive. And she actually moved to Hawaii, and this is the little hospital where this study was carried out. Actually, it's interesting that it was funded by Dr. Earl Bakken, who invented the cardiac pacemaker, the implantable cardiac pacemaker. He was an electronic engineer. He went on to found Medtronic, which is the largest medical device manufacturing corporation in the world. And of all things, he had an interest in remote healing. Well, he moved to Hawaii, and he invited Dr. Ochterberg over. She left her position in California, devoted herself to this study totally. She spent 2 years integrating herself with these Native American Hawaiian shamans, I should say Native Hawaiian shamans, before actually beginning this study. They took her into their confidence, shared their methods with her, and then she told them to do something that was utterly unique. She told the shamans themselves to go out and select a patient that you have a heart connection with, that you have worked with in the past, that you feel richly and deeply connected with emotionally and spiritually, and bring them back, and then, if they're willing, we'll scan their brains while you do your healing thing. So with each individual in the fMRI scanner, the healer, at a distance, at randomized two-minute intervals, sent healing intentions while the fMRI was scanning their brain. And in 10 of the 11 of these subjects, only during the sin condition, but not during the no-sin condition, certain specific areas in the brain lit up on the scan, indicating increased metabolic activity. These were the frontal, the precuneus, and the anterior and middle cingulate regions. And the statistical analysis showed that there was only one chance in about 10,000 that you could explain these results according to chance. This is the way these studies should be done. And if you sanitize these studies and take away the emotional, caring, compassionate, empathic connections between a healer and a subject, these studies simply do not work very well. Well, Chris Rowe, who is a young investigator at the University of Northampton, recently did a beautiful meta-analysis of these healing studies. There were 57 studies involving whole human beings, 49 of these studies including non-humans, which we'll get into in a moment, and the results of this analysis showed that results in the active condition exhibit a significant improvement in well-being relative to control subjects. The results do not seem to be susceptible to placebo and expectancy effects, and the effect size is small, but it is statistically significant. Now, this has been affirmed by at least eight other systematic or meta-analyses, according to my count, and almost all of these that have been published in peer-reviewed literature show positive conclusions. Now, if you want to stay up with what's happening in this field, there's a website which Rupert Sheldrake and I and seven other people put together. It's called the opensciences.org website. It contains what we call a manifesto for a post-materialist science. And so this is one way to stay current on what's happening in this field. You cannot do this by reading premier, top-tier medical journals because, by and large, they are allergic to publishing this sort of thing. Now, I want to assert to you that this is a hugely busy, industrious area, and there is increasing evidence of an intrinsic connectivity and unity in biological systems. Now, this is where consciousness and healing research is headed. Your children may not approve of these directions, but I'll bet you your grandchildren and great-grandchildren will look back on this era and they will say, why on earth did you all have so much trouble with this? This is hard evidence. It's abundant. Let me give you a sense of, or the flavor of what this stuff looks like. Let's drop back to biological simplicity here and talk about connectivity and unity between cells. One interesting study was done about 10 years ago by Dr. Rita Pizzi and her colleagues at the University of Milan. They looked at the ability of human neurons, these were human brain neurons, to communicate with one another. These were shielded in petri dishes in the laboratory at a distance. Both of them were in lead-lined boxes called Faraday cages, and it was impossible for them to communicate by any standard conventional means. And so when one group of these neurons were stimulated by a laser light, the distant shielded group of neurons registered the same changes at the same time, although both of them were shielded, which prevented any obvious form of physical communication. They didn't believe the results. They repeated this study many, many times with an identical outcome and finally went public with it. You can find this on the NASA Smithsonian website, the entire study. Dr. Pizzi concluded, our experimental data seem to strongly suggest that biological systems present non-local properties not explainable by classical models. This has encouraged other research come forward with essentially the same experimental design. One of these was Dr. Ashkan Farhadi and his colleagues at Rush Medical Center in Chicago. They used not human neurons, but human epithelial cells. And when one group of these human epithelial cells was poisoned with hydrogen peroxide, the distant shielded group of human epithelial cells responded in the same way, even though there was no way they could communicate by any known physical means. A more recent study has taken place at UCLA School of Medicine by Dr. Victor Chaban and his colleagues. They used neuroblastoma cancer cells, which were able to communicate with normal neurons when both were shielded, preventing, once again, any known means of communication. Now, this is hard science. This is replicated science by different investigators in different laboratories, which are all criteria of proper science. One question that was touched on by Peter last night was, how about brains? I mean, we've looked at individual neurons communicating at a distance. What about our favorite batch of neurons, which is our own brain? Can they do the same thing? Well, Peter gave you evidence from hyperscanning techniques last night that the answer to this is yes. In addition, there are now on the books at least a dozen experiments that show that distant brains of people who are emotionally close can simultaneously register a stimulus when only one of them is stimulated. Now, if you want to chase these studies down, they're on Dr. Dean Radin's blog site, R-A-D-I-N. If you just Google that, you'll find all of these studies under his website. Now, in addition to these kinds of studies, I think some of the real treasure, research-wise, in this whole area are non-human experiments. And I say that because skeptics are always saying that if you work on people, you know, they are subject to placebo effects, expectation, suggestion, positive thinking, and that sort of thing. If you find the same thing in non-humans, you really have something to go on, because presumably bacteria and plants and fungi don't think positively. And this is one reason why the skeptics almost never attack this body of information, because it bypasses, it leapfrogs most of the chronic objections to human studies. So these studies have been lumped together, and they're called DMILS studies, which is an acronym for Distant Mental Interactions with Living Systems. Now, people have been able to use their intentions to increase the growth rate of bacteria in test tubes, as you see here, and also to inhibit intentionally the growth rate of those bacteria in test tubes. You can do the same thing, and it has been done many times, looking not at bacteria but fungi. The germination rate of seeds and the growth rate of seedlings have been shown to respond to intentionality. And I think the most significant is the research in animals, particularly mice. And I want to mention a study which I think ranks at the top in terms of human significance potentially in this area, and it has been done by Dr. William Bingston, who of all things is a sociologist at St. Joseph's College in New York. He learned healing from a street person. It's a fascinating tale, and you can read about it in Bingston's book. It's called The Energy Cure. It's in paperback. But now these studies have been repeated in three academic centers in the United States with identical findings. What he does is to transplant breast cancer, human adenocarcinoma of the breast cells, into mice. This is a terrible thing to do to mice, because 100% of these mice die within 30 days. This is a horribly invasive, destructive cancer in mice. And so if you don't do anything to these mice, they're all dead in 30 days. There are no survivors. Well, when Bingston does what he does, and this is a complex mental process I won't even attempt to go into. You can read about it. It's fully explained in the book, The Energy Cure. But 90% of these mice get well. The cancer just inspissates, becomes smaller. It forms a black scab, which eventually falls off. And these mice go on and live their normal mouse lives. Well, this is astonishing, as you can imagine. It absolutely horrifies certain biologists who think that this can't possibly come about as a result of human intentions, but it apparently does. Bingson has challenged the materialists who don't believe this by taking skeptical, disbelieving second-year college students. You can't find anybody more cynical than the second-year college students who don't believe any of this, but he teaches them the technique. They get the same cure rate as Bingston himself does. Now, there's something interesting, fascinating, and potentially hugely important about this research. After these mice are healed and the adenocarcinoma cells have inspissated, scabbed over, and fallen off, you cannot then go back and transplant them again with human breast cancer tissue because on the second trial, the cancer will not take. These mice have become immune to human breast cancer. This has raised all sorts of hope that this animal model might portend the development of a vaccine for breast cancer in women. And I can tell you that this has attracted the attentions of a lot of pharmaceutical companies in the United States currently. So we'll see. The other area of evidence favoring non-local healing is the area of so-called spontaneous remissions, which everybody has heard of from time to time. When I was in medical school, I was told that these are so rare, you'll probably spend your whole life as a doctor and you'll never see one of these things. I think that's entirely false for reasons I'll mention. But the reason to classify these as a function of healing intentionality is that almost always these studies take place in a hothouse of empathy, caring, compassion, and love of one person for another. Now, a classical case was reported, actually, it wasn't reported, unfortunately, but it took place in 1952. I just want to mention this to give you a flavor of how sensational these things are and what they look like. It involved a 4-year-old girl who was dying of acute lymphocytic leukemia at the University of Maryland Hospital in Baltimore. And at that time, in the early 50s, there was no cure for this disease. There was no proper treatment. Her disease was 100% fatal in 1952. She was dying. She was given last rites. But her mother was a feisty woman who would not let her go. And so one day, before she died, the mother assembled several nuns from the hospital, and they bundled up this little girl and took her to a cemetery and laid her at the grave of Mother Elizabeth Seton, who would later be canonized as the first female saint in the United States. Well, they prayed over her, this little girl, and bundled her up and took her back to the hospital, and she wouldn't die. A few days later, she appeared to be getting well. They repeated all of her blood tests, and they were totally normal. So finally, they discharged her home. This was reported to the Vatican, but they thought this might be kind of a temporary remission. They waited 9 years before they acted on this case, and even before acting, demanded a bone marrow biopsy to make sure there were no residual cancer cells in the bone marrow. It was normal, and finally, she was declared a miracle by the Catholic Church. This case was never reported. I became involved with this because I'd written a book about this stuff, and I was contacted by a reporter from the Washington Post who had dug this case up 40 years later, and she began to wonder why on earth this case was never reported in any medical literature. So she went back and she found the doctor who was caring for this little girl back in 1952. And he was Dr. Milton Sachs. He was the most eminent oncology doctor in the United States at the time. To his credit, he went on to develop therapies for acute lymphocytic leukemia in children and contributed greatly to the cure rates now in this disease. But she said to this doctor, this famous doctor, why didn't you report it? And to his credit, he said, the only reason this case has not been written up is that I have been afraid to. And so you would want to ask, I think, afraid of what? And that the answer, I think, almost always is that there is fear of one's reputation. Particularly academic doctors refuse to get involved with this stuff. It is just too freaky. And so these cases sit on the sidelines. We have no clear idea how many there are, but we know, because they are not reported, there are bound to be more than we think. This is the best book that's ever been written on this area. This is an annotated bibliography of 3,500 of these cases culled from 800 medical journals worldwide, including 20 languages. Now, what's the mechanism here? How might this stuff work? First of all, I think that the term mechanism is the wrong term. This almost certainly is not mechanical. Actually, I know how it works. and I'm so happy that you're here this weekend so I can share it with you. Here's how it works. Something unknown is doing, we don't know what. This is a comment by Sir Arthur Eddington in a different context, but I like to apply it to this area because it's foolproof, I think. You know, people have looked around for ages about how people might communicate at a distance. One category of theories is transmission theories, where people look for some sort of gross or subtle energy connecting two people. I don't think this has any chance of success. Nobody has ever found anything energy-wise, subtle or gross, to account for this. It is the case, I think, that a lot of consciousness researchers are moving on to other hypotheses involving the theme of this conference, looking at non-local connections between distant entities. Now, let me remind you that non-locality is a term that has found a home in quantum physics. And in quantum physics, if you have two photons or electrons that are once in contact and you spread them apart, hypothetically, to the ends of the universe, when you change one, the other changed instantly and to the same degree. Nobody knows how this happens. But I want to say that physics does not own non-locality. Human beings were experiencing non-local events millennia before physics stumbled onto non-locality in the 20th century. And we are not obliged to give over non-locality to physics. Now, there are some famous theoreticians who think that consciousness has a home even in the non-locality that is bespoken in quantum mechanics. Among them is the dean of theoretical physics in the U.S., Henry Stapp at Berkeley. The new physics presents prima facie evidence that our human thoughts are linked to nature by non-local connections. What a person chooses to do in one region seems immediately to affect what is true somewhere else in the universe. In other words, our thoughts do something. Now, I must say that you Brits are getting in on this act. This is out of Oxford University from physicist Vlatko Vedral, who is endorsing non-locality in the human domain. I don't know if any of you came across this issue of Scientific American about 3 or 4 years ago, in which a cover article was devoted to the theme of living in a quantum world. And this is what Vedral has to say. The quintessential quantum effect, entanglement, can occur in large systems, including living organisms. These effects are more pervasive than anyone ever suspected. They may operate in the cells of our body. The entanglements are primary. Here you see hotshot physicists building bridges between non-locality in physics and non-locality in biological systems. I don't know if you've had Dr. Dean Radin to speak to this group or not, but he would be a great person to have discuss some of these issues. He says, and he's the chief scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences in the States, I propose that psi is the human experience of the quantum entangled universe. The ontological parallels implied by quantum entanglement in psi are so compelling that I believe they'd be foolish to ignore. He goes on to say in his book, Entangled Minds, minds are entangled with the universe. So in principle, minds can non-locally influence anything, including a collection of other minds or physical systems. So the question persists, and it hasn't been answered yet. Can quantum physics account for distant healing and other distant connections between individuals? I can only share with you an opinion, and I think we have to be careful here. I don't think quantum physics can fully explain healing in people. The reason is straightforward. Vital factors and distant intentionality in healing in the human domain involve things that are just completely missing in quantum physics, such as compassion, caring, empathy, love. You can search the equations of quantum physics and you will never find any room for these kinds of factors. Compassion, caring, empathy, and love. They do not exist in the context of quantum physics. So I think we have to move on to other theoretical formulations in areas of science. Dr. Roger Penrose, another one of your countrymen, expressed that this way: my position on consciousness demands a major revolution in physics. There's something very fundamental missing from current science. Our understanding at this time is not adequate, and we're going to have to move to new regions of science. Well, I think regardless of which side of the fence we find ourselves on with respect to these questions about the relationship between quantum non-locality and biological non-locality, there is room for an enormous amount of humility in this discussion. As Yogi Berra, a famous U.S. baseball player, said, it's not the heat, it's the humility. And so I just want to emphasize that there's so much we do not understand about the nature of consciousness. Now, if you listen to materialists, you will hear that we're just on the verge of cracking the whole thing open, and the brain makes consciousness, and we're just this far any day now from showing how this is going to happen. You can buy that if you want to, but a lot of thoughtful people do not buy that idea. Among them is my favorite cognitive science in the U.S., Donald Hoffman at UC Irvine. The scientific study of consciousness is in the embarrassing position of having no scientific theory of consciousness. Steven Pinker at Harvard, an experimental psychologist, was asked, how in the world could consciousness be produced by the brain? He said, beats the heck out of me. I have some prejudices, but I have no idea how to begin to look for a defensible answer, and neither does anyone else. Manus Kafatas, an academic physicist in the U.S., about how the brain could produce consciousness, such a process has not and never will be specified. It amounts to saying that table salt, once it enters the body, finds a way to dissolve in the blood, enter the brain, and in doing so, learns how to think, feel, and reason. Positing consciousness is more fundamental than anything physical is the most reasonable alternative. I actually take perverse delight in multiplying these comments. Stuart Kaufman, a theoretical biologist, highly respected in the U.S., nobody has the faintest idea what consciousness is. I don't have any idea, nor does anybody else, including the philosophers of mind. Freeman Dyson, one of the most famous physicists in the world currently, the origin of life is a total mystery, and so is the existence of human consciousness. We have no clear idea how the electrical discharges occurring in nerve cells in our brains are connected with our feelings, desires, and actions. These are not third-tier scientists just mouthing off. These are some of the most eminent scientists in Western culture. Among the philosophers taking a stand on this is Jerry Fodor at Rutgers, one of the most eminent mind-body philosophers out there. Nobody has the slightest idea how anything material could be conscious. Nobody even knows what it would be like to have the slightest idea how anything material could be conscious. So much for the philosophy of consciousness. If the brain were so simple we could understand it, we would be so simple we couldn't. And the great Simone Weil, bragging about one's intelligence is like an animal bragging about the size of its cage. Well, I want to wind down this discussion by focusing on some ethical issues that come to mind, and I'm going out farther on this limb, and we'll see if you can go with me. I just think, for reasons stated, that there's compelling evidence that there's some aspect of our consciousness that is non-local, by which I mean that it is unconfined to specific points in space, such as brains or bodies, and furthermore, it's unconfined to specific points in time, such as the present. Therefore, it must be infinite in space and time. Now, this is not just my view. I think that Dr. Pim Van Lommel has spoken to your group before. Well, he says, I strongly believe that consciousness cannot be located in a particular time and place. This is known as non-locality. Complete and endless consciousness is everywhere. Near-death experience, and I would add many other additional lines of evidence, prompted the concept of non-local and endless consciousness. Ultimately, we cannot avoid the conclusion that consciousness has always been and always will be independent of the body. Now, hang in there with me about this. If consciousness is non-local or infinite in time, then in some sense, it is eternal and immortal. Now, again, this has been a view that has been promoted by some of the giants within quantum physics in the 20th century. Schrodinger got there before almost anybody. I venture to call the mind indestructible, since it has a peculiar timetable. Namely, the mind is always now. There is really no before or after for the mind. This has never been a mystery to poets. T.S. Eliot, to be conscious is not to be in time. Another corollary. If consciousness is non-local or infinite in space, then it's everywhere in space, which is just a way of saying that it's omnipresent. And, therefore, if consciousness is omnipresent, that means you can't put it in a box and separate it from all the other consciousnesses that are out there, so that in some sense, all minds must come together to form a single unitary mind. Now, there have been consciousness researchers in the field of parapsychology who have been promoting this point of view for some time. Among them is Stephen Broad, who is the current editor of the Journal of Scientific Exploration and an academic philosopher. The evidence from parapsychology suggests ways in which our psychic interactions may intimately link all conscious beings and all objects, no matter how physically distant, into a kind of global community. One of the most gifted consciousness researchers of our generation was Dr. William Broad, who passed a few years ago. It may be that our deep interconnectedness with each other and with all of nature is the major conclusion that issues forth from the many findings of consciousness research. And so this idea of a unitary collective consciousness echoes through some of the insights of the greatest scientists, as I've already mentioned, including, once again, Schrodinger. To divide or multiply consciousness is something meaningless. There's obviously only one alternative, he says, namely the unification of minds or consciousness. In truth, there is only one mind. David Bohm has been mentioned at this conference. Deep down, the consciousness of mankind is one. This is a virtual certainty, and if we don't see this, it's because we are blinding ourselves to it. And so what are the implications for health care globally? Well, as a physician, these fascinate me. I think that if we're all connected, there is always a collective global aspect to personal health, so that personal health is never merely personal. If consciousness is unitary, then the health of one person affects the health of everybody else. So that the health of this beautiful Western baby on the left is never totally separate from the health of these three refugee children in East Africa. Now, David mentioned last night that it may be possible to take an extended view of the golden rule, which, when you think about it, is sort of selfish. In its usual expression, it says, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. I think in view of the evidence for a unitary factor bringing us all together, we can rejig the golden rule to something like this. Be kind to others because in some sense they are you. Believe it or not, I'm almost done. I think this has immense relevance to our own survival. And I think that this unitary idea of the mind, by fostering cooperation between people and love for all sentient life and the earth itself, just may assist our own survival. And I would take this further. I think that without this awareness, it isn't clear that we're going to survive as a species. So in the end, I think it may be all about love, which when you think about what love is, it's the overcoming of boundaries and separation between people. And this is the essential expression of non-locality. One person who saw this coming was D.H. Lawrence. And he said once that hate is not the opposite of love. The opposite of love is individuality. And he was talking here not about healthy individuality, which is absolutely necessary for the development of a person's sense of who they are. He was talking about what has become a pathological version of individuality with which our culture is obsessed with. And it has led to an epidemic globally of greed and selfishness and destructiveness. Actually, Sir Isaac Newton was onto this idea. He said, we build too many walls and not enough bridges. So I would ask you whether or not love does have a place in science or not. Well, one of your members of this group, Dr. Chris Clark, the physicist at the University of Southampton, gives a yes answer to that. He says, I've never come across any naturalist or ecologist who does not have a love and wonder for the creatures and landscapes that they investigate, whether or not they express it. When I began to write about these things, particularly the unity between people's thoughts and those microbes and bacteria and fungi we've been talking about, I received a flood of letters from scientists who actually work with these little critters. This was a comment from one academic microbiologist. She said, I'm not surprised by these studies. I feel connected with these little creatures. I love them. And I was actually inundated with letters from veterinarians. One female veterinarian said, when I'm operating on animals, I feel as if I'm intimately connected with my patients. I love them profoundly. Well, Alice Walker, the American novelist, stood up for love. She said, anything we love can be saved, including our own skins. Again, this has never been a mystery to poets. W.H. Auden said, we must love one another or die. Aldous Huxley, another one of your countrymen, put it this way. People often ask me, what is the most effective technique for transforming their life? It's a little embarrassing that after years and years of research and experimentation, I have to say that the best answer is just be a little kinder. Actually, Huxley said that on his deathbed when people asked him if he had any message for those who would remain behind. Henry James, the novelist and brother of William James, called the father of American psychology, said, "Three things in life are important. The first is to be kind, the second is to be kind, and the third is to be kind." And I leave you with a brief poem from the 14th century Persian poet Hafiz. "Let's go deeper, for if we do, our spirits will embrace and interweave. Our union will be so glorious that even God will not be able to tell us apart." Thank you, UK.
Anybody, any table that is keen to ask a question?
Hello, Larry. I'm Paul Kinyevich. You touched on a very explosive subject when you talked about spontaneous healings, because in the eyes of religious people, you're questioning whether there is such a thing as a miracle, a supernatural agency acting outside the laws of nature. That's the way a miracle is defined, and which is regarded by the Catholic Church, and by the way, I'm not a Catholic, but I live in a very Catholic country, which is Poland, and miracles are regarded as proof of sainthood, of course. But the question I would that you're raising, to which I would really like to see your answer, is there such a thing as a miracle in the sense of an agency acting outside the laws of nature?
Well, I think if something happens in nature, it's natural. I do not intend my comments to disallow the influence of a transcendent agency. I think that this is trans-science, the possibility that God or a supreme being might be involved. I think the question is open. I cannot imagine an experiment in science that could tease apart how this happens. And so I leave open the possibility of a transcendent agency. As to the definition of a miracle, look it up in the dictionary. It comes from the Latin mirari, which means to marvel or experience awe at something. So anything that causes awe and wonder in us could be called a miracle. I furthermore align myself with St. Augustine, who said that miracles do not happen in opposition to nature. They happen in opposition to what we know about nature. Yeah. So I'm pretty open to the idea of the intervention of a supreme being, however conceived. And just to clarify, I'm not fronting for any religion or in opposition to any religion. I happen not to belong to any organized religion myself, having escaped one in my youth. but I'm totally open to the idea of divine intervention.
Okay.
Yep.
Right. Who's our second one? Right. Come up here, would you? Quick questions, quick answers. Yeah, if you want to sit down, do.
Our table discussed why are we being told this when we know it? We know that love works. It's obvious that neglect and abandonment doesn't work. And some of the answers that we came up with was that... firstly, how do we manifest it was our big question. Secondly, that capitalism works in other directions, so it's counterproductive forces. We discussed fear and personal survival. And obviously, when everything's going well, it's fine. and you can manifest love, but under conditions of fear that we start competing and we're threatened and all that evolutionary biology. And then within that, we were asking, you know, is there love in science? You know, if we're being told this and we know it, and the answer to it is that scientists are people, and so love is in people and love is in scientists. And we had a bit of a conversation about a worry in research about killing mice and rats to produce results. And our final point on it was we are actually starting to open up the concept of love itself, and that there was a skepticism to even use the word love. And Gerd mentioned her definition of feeling for organisms at all levels, which I think was very much in your conversation about that it's about kindness rather than this great overarching love. So I don't know if you've got any comments to that, but it's not really a question. It was
well, I wanted to.
Thank you.
I'd like to express my regrets that any animals were killed in this research. I think there are better ways to make the point than sacrificing mice or rats or anything else. As to discussing things that you already know, I just must say, this is a very tough audience. This is not metaphysics 101. I know that most of you have spent a lifetime, many of you, getting to where you are in your spiritual path. So in many ways, I really do feel like I'm speaking to the choir. But as a minister once told me, Larry, considering the poor state of choirs these days, they... they need speaking to. I do think that even though most of you would probably agree in general to what I've expressed, I have found that even people who follow those ideas can have their beliefs validated and empowered in some degree by learning that there is a side to science which affirms what you already believe. Most of us live our lives thinking that we have to split off into either scientific or non-scientific directions, and I am totally opposed to that schizophrenic split in human beingness, and have dedicated my life to trying to heal it. So I have no apologies in preaching to you, choir.
Okay, thanks, Larry, very much.
Okay, our last contributor.
Well, thank you. Our table was unanimous with you, but really asking how can we manifest it, particularly in a country where the NHS is going down.
Well, I think we can fall back on Henry James' comment. In all of our life, we just try to be a little kinder. I mean, I think that's probably the bottom line for all of us. I think it all does come down to love. Beyond that, I think we can be strategic in trying to talk about the directions that are being taken in science that affirm what we already know to be the case in this room. I think there's a huge reason to try to move the vector of belief in this culture away from materialism and denial of the spiritual and transcendent side of life. One of the expressions of that, which I'm captivated by, is the impact of spiritual practices on health and longevity, as I tried to say. I think we need to talk about those things in addition to being a little kinder.
Okay. Well, Larry, thank you very much indeed for a fantastic talk. Mark, you, I think there are many members of the choir which won't have seen a lot of the data which you put up. I think it's remarkable. And one of the things which is exciting me is that it will, in fact, go out on the web. Okay. So I'll ask you all to thank Larry again for his fantastic presentation.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you so much.
And back here at 10 past.